This is lecture 1.1, the text of the Old Testament. Before I begin, I want to make one clarification. I think on the last, first lecture, I made an inaccurate statement. It's 39 books in the Septuagint-based or English translations that you have, over against Josephus's 22 count. Modern Hebrew, or should we say the Masoretic tradition, counts 24, by the way. In this case, Jeremiah Lamentations have been separated, Lamentations in the Kethubim, and also the Judges Ruth combination has been separated, Ruth once again in the Kethubim. So I just want to make that clarification before we begin. Now, let's focus on 1.1, the text of the Old Testament. Here you'll be introduced to probably a lot of material that is brand new to you, and it's intended to open your eyes concerning the different Hebrew language-based text, or the different Old Testament language-based text. So this will help you as you move into learning Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic, and further your studying of a high level of the Old Testament text. One thing that is important to note, that although in the original PowerPoint there was a 1.2 text criticism, that lecture has been changed, expanded, and I will be giving that along with the lecture block included in the study of Jeremiah. So let's begin from there. If you notice on slide two, we have the rabbinic statement from Rabbi Ishmael: "My son, be careful, because your work is the work of heaven. Should you omit one letter or add one letter, the whole world will be destroyed." Obviously, such words from the Talmud, Babylonian Talmud, is enough to make one respect the long tradition of the manuscript, the textual tradition being carried on in a very accurate and fine way. And in many biblical introductions that are evangelical and fundamentalist based, this idea is pushed to the max. However, it's important to note that these rabbinic ideas are such that are based more in terms of the well-developed 7th century and following Masoretic text. So these words probably cannot be so applied to earlier manuscripts and biblical understanding. Scholars nowadays, especially in light of the Qumran material, talk about the era from maybe 200 BCE to about 100 CE as being a time in which the text was in a pluriform state. In other words, in the Septuagints, as they developed, and many other Qumran indigenous forms, etc., are beginning to develop. And it is very likely that the church, or the Bible that the early church was faced with, was pluriform in nature. And it's important to understand that, rather than be led astray by looking at something that ways of looking at the text that is found beyond the 7th century. Okay, so with that clarification, I think it's important that we move on. Slide 3. There are many witnesses to the Old Testament, or the First Testament. The Hebrew is the easiest to deal with, basically because it is not a translation, we believe. And when you deal with translations, secondary material, you need to deal with the concept of retroversion. Okay? What is retroversion? Well, retroversion is actually, you have to take, let's say, the Septuagint wording, which is in Greek, presupposing that it originally came from a Hebrew vorlog and has been translated into Greek. And retroversion means that when you look at the Septuagint text and you want to think about what it looked like before, you have to retranslate it back into Hebrew. That's what the retroversion is. Okay, so when we talk about the Hebrew Bible, however, you notice in slide 4 that the earliest outside of that Judean desert Dead Sea Scroll material was the famous Nash Papyri, which is probably identified in 1st and 2nd century CE, which has just parts of the Decalogue, etc. We'll talk about this a little bit later. Outside of that, obviously, the Qumran finds are your most important. Although the early church fathers were already interested in comparing the Hebrew text along with the different Greek versions, it was really not until Origen in the 3rd century that a detailed document was produced. He produced what is called the Hexapla, which is actually a 6-column study with on one end a transliterated Hebrew text. Okay, now what do I mean by transliterated? Well, it's if you read it, if you look at the letters, it's in Greek. Okay, so it's transliterated into Greek. But if you try to read it, it's not the Greek language; it's the Hebrew language. So it gives us what Origen believes to be believed to have been the pronunciation. So he supplied the vowels, etc. Maybe through some early rabbinic friends that helped him out. So either way, it's not until this period that you have a well-established comparison. He obviously, and we begin a process of comparison and contrast. If you notice on one of the pictures that I have is the modern reconstructed Hexapla by Fields. Please realize that that there are the Hexapla did not last. We gather bits and pieces from Eusebius and all sorts of other sources and have compiled it together. That process is continuing even today. There is actually a website that's dedicated to actually producing a new Hexapla to further our study of that era. In the next slide, we talk about the fact that Jerome is probably the next important character along this line. His task of taking the Old Greek, which was probably very fragmentary, translated bits and pieces by different translators, and then to rework it. Now, the problem, however, is that his reworking took the shape of actually taking the Hebrew Bible and comparing and contrasting it and translating it, but still having a lot of the Septuagint in the background as he translated it into Latin. Okay, so here we do have a development of these early sources. Now, let's focus on the main, okay, the Hebrew Bible that we use today in the Biblia Hebraica Septuagintensia is Codex Leningradus, which is dated to about the year 1000. CE. So it's a rather late work. The Masoretic tradition was probably in full swing 7th, 8th, 9th century. And so this is a much later work. But however, there was a proto-Masoretic text, and these can have made their way back to as early as the Qumran text, which is your earliest attestation, maybe 150, 200 BCE. So it works back to that early time period. And at the same time, there is still room for movement. And it's important to realize, as I will indicate, the proto-Masoretic text did not have vowel points. This is something that was later added under the Masoretes as an interpretative device. So, let's return, and I'm dealing with a quotation from Immanuel Tov, who is probably one of the best to summarize this material. The name Masoretic text refers to a group of manuscripts and other sources, all of which are close to each other. Many of the elements of these manuscripts and even their final form were determined in the early Middle Ages. Notice the Middle Ages. But they continue a much earlier tradition. Like I said, moving all the way back to some of the, as represented in some of the Qumran or the Judean, the desert scrolls. I think as a group of manuscripts, are one in which there is a certain amount of variance that's allowed. The scholars David Noel Friedman and also Anderson, these two scholars worked over some very detailed points, and they asked the question, well, what kind of variance can be found within the Masoretic tradition? They claim that approximately 85% of, if 85% of the material, that is vowel points and different accentuation marks, if they are the same 85%, that means with a 15% error margin, then they are considered within that textual grouping. Okay, and that is also so here. You know, there might be a little higher percentage depending on the scholarly analysis, but remember this idea that one letter, okay, a letter being off that we had in that rabbinic quote by Rabbi Ishmael is not really accurate when you go through the manuscripts themselves and grapple with these kind of distinctions. Okay. Slide 8. The name Masoretic text was given to this group because of the apparatus, okay, the Masorah attached to it. Okay, this apparatus, which was added to the consonantal base, developed from early tradition, the larger, the smaller, and the Masorah smaller tends to be those writings and Aramaic notations that are placed on the side of the text or in between the text. Okay, what's involved here? Well, some of the things that will be is they will look at a phrase or a word and they will claim that it is found only once. Now, the problem is it found only once in the book? Is it found only once in the Torah? Is it found only once in the Bible? Okay, is it a clear hapax legomena? Sometimes there will be an indication of found twice. Also, you'll find indications of kere, kethib, that is, it is to be read, it is to be written, which obviously is a Masoretic scribal correction technique that was used. So all these type and many more notations are found in this smaller Masorah that's inscribed around the text. Even in the Masorah of the Codex Leningradus, you have this. But the larger Masorah actually has a more detailed listings of those passages that might be significantly different. And for example, Ginsberg has made a 6-volume collection of this. You can download this. It's been made into a PDF file. And so the details are all given out in this way. Now, there's really a misunderstanding that took place earlier on. Even Eli safeguard that manuscript, not all texts. And so to compile them all together was a process which on one side we can understand. It's an attempt to assist in having a rather clean text in text criticism. We find out that actually Levitas actually moved in that direction. This is that man that we referred to in the last lecture that Kaiser had quoted. At the same time, it can be misunderstood because the Masorah is intended for each manuscript. Okay? This is to guarantee the accuracy of that one manuscript. Okay? And once again, remember, this is a late development, not something that was found in the Qumran period. Okay. Slide number 9 is a list of those characteristics that are Masoretic in nature. Okay? Now, these are things that are worthy to be remembered, especially for a quiz. For example, or a test, number 1, the Masoretic text contained the consonantal text found in the Proto-Masoretic text of the Second Temple era and the Masorah, and the Masorah which developed later. In other words, the core is that of the consonantal text, only consonants. Okay? Then, along with that, obviously, the Masorah is added. Okay, so those are the two things in that first little notch there. Number 2, but they chose not to represent those vowels. Vowels, as a general rule, did not show up on the alphabetic scale until the Greeks found it necessary to throw in those vowel letters. So they transform some of them. Whereas in Hebrew, developing from, let's say, a Canaanite Phoenician background, they found it unnecessary. However, your problem is that there can be multiple readings of the consonants unless there are vowel pointings. So we find out that the Masoretes actually limited the interpretation of the passage, and they interpreted it by giving vowel points. Now, to a large extent, they might be accurate, but if you're doing text critical work and you think that something might be wrong, the first place probably to look at is to question if the Masoretic vowel pointings are inaccurate and they should have been pointed another way. Now, I could talk for hours on this subject in terms of the vowel pointings, because we find out that after the Reformation, there was a strong move, and it's the early developments of what we might call the inerrancy movement with men like Turrentine. There was a move to understand that even the vowel points were inspired of God. Well, this became a major point of controversy in early text criticism, because obviously they were added years later. A 7th century, 8th century, and the time that they're not accurate would be foolhardy also. So it's just that these are later additions and need to be recognized as such, and we should be flexible in terms of grappling with them. Third, we find paratextual elements. Paratextual elements could be paragraph divisions that are identified in the text. We're not talking about chapter and verse. Stephen Langton is the one that added these, and this is not added until quite a bit later when the Gutenberg Revolution takes place and printed editions of the Hebrew Bible come out. We need to hold off a little bit in terms of that. But paratextual elements would tend to be those indications of paragraph pericopes in terms of reading units that have been grappled with for years. Next, the accentuation. There is a detailed series of accentuations in both the poetic and narrative literature. We find out that these accents are divided into conjunctive, to combine words, or disjunctive, to separate them. Okay, and they are then variegated into different levels. In fact, the understanding of a sentence was governed by these accentuation marks. And so that you have one that's called an athna, which automatically divides the sentence in two. At least, obviously, is the apparatus of the Masorah in its full form. Okay, these all are added, making a quite different perspective on the Bible. In the next couple slides, we refer you to some helpful sources. One is Christian D. Ginsburg's Introduction to the Masoretic Critical Edition of the Hebrew Bible, 1897. It's been reformatted and with a new introduction. It's important to know that although we do not have a copy of it in the APTS library, it is online at several locations. Okay, and I have a URL for one of them. The next is a more recent volume, and it's a rather thin volume. I think it's only about 80 pages of text with a little bit of further indexing. And it's by Kelly, Manat, and Crawford. Okay, these three scholars have put together what is called the Masorah of the Biblical Hebraica Stuttgartensia. Now, the work is a user-friendly work, and it introduced you to the whole reading of the Masorah. Now, one of the scholars here, Mayet, his doctoral dissertation deals specifically with what is called the sub-loci, and the sub-loci of the Masoretic text. And what this is that the person that was working on the Masorah major, the larger Masorah, he never completed of the work of the Masorah that he produced. And these are all different questionable passages which he had comments on. So Minette has gone through, for his doctoral dissertation, gone through all these sub-loci comments and have tried to solve them since they died before he could produce it. So obviously a well-informed individual to help in this very neat volume. Obviously, Emmanuel Tove on the next slide, his textual criticism of the Hebrew Bible is a must-use. Notice that there is a second English edition. And then there is the Israel Yevin has done a work for Scholars Press, Introduction to the Tiberian Masorah. I find that Ginsburg and Yavin's work are very, very helpful. It's very, very detailed, and it covers almost everything that you really need to know about the Masoretic text. Now, let's talk a little bit about the history and the development of this Masoretic text. The Masoretic text, the Proto-Masoretic text, probably developed via the Pharisees, okay? Strong temple ties. Now, remember, as I said, the Proto-Masoretic, okay, and it was nurtured and developed within the temple setting. There are, within Talmudic literature and other literature, discussions about temple scrolls that seem to be used to weigh other scrolls. Now, you need to, I hope it's not too much of a shock to you, but these three scrolls that were used in the temple are what seem to be three scrolls, even that is a debatable issue, obviously were different. But they were still used as a measuring rod to judge other scrolls. One scholar named Lieberman, really before the Qumran scrolls were discovered, has given a detailed study of the different manuscripts that were around, and he understood these temple scrolls as one, then the scrolls that were used in the synagogues in a reading setting was another, and of pretty high accuracy, and then he talked about the fact that there's probably other more vulgar, is a term that begins to develop, texts that were for popular usage and popular consumptions, and their accuracies varied. If you read some of the Talmud and later rabbinic works, there are evidences of these variant readings that you can follow. Okay, now let's come back. The bottom line, however, is to realize that the core, moving from Proto-Masoretic, the Pharisees seem to have been the caretakers, and they ushered in on that basis. The period of internal differences in the textual transmission, this period comes to an end at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. We can speculate that there have been many scholars that have written on a supposed explanation that with the destruction of the temple, obviously Judaism had to shift to a much stronger book-based religion, and therefore the variants were not allowed as much. Now, this is, in my opinion, a good hypothesis, but we're not sure. There have been further studies and most recent works that talk about the movement from an oral culture to a literate culture. And within that movement, we need to realize that for the Bible to ever have been written in terms of the Old Testament, and a collection of disparate authors' works put together in one volume and have that understood as authoritative is a major tour de force within history. Okay? And we do realize that Judaism did struggle with this early on because of the concept of the oral Torah. Okay? And in other words, they found that the oral Torah was very, very early period, and I call it a pluriform period. The Qumran material contains not only proto-Masoretic texts, but also pre-Samaritan, Hebrew sources for the Septuagint, Qumran origin, and even what Tovis called a non-aligned text. One that's a little bit difficult to understand and fully identify. Now, I should indicate that Emanuel Tov, who was the major editor of the Qumran material, his writings over the past 20 years show some major shifting in terms of the percentage of these manuscripts. Even his first edition of the text criticism of the Old Testament and the second edition will show a major difference. And although the pagination, the books are exactly the same, his percentages of these textual groupings have radically changed. If you want to know further about this, we can talk about it. I've written a portion of this in my dissertation, cataloging Tov's change along the lines. Now, the next slide, slide 14, the difference in the proto-Masoretic group and the latter Masoretic tends to be limited to single words, phrases, although this understanding may change according to Emanuel Tov. we're not quite sure yet to what extent this takes place. The Talmud and later rabbinic literature have preserved other early variants. Let me once again talk a little bit more about this. Masoretic text, okay, and if we call a Masoretic text not only the Masoretic text of Genesis, but of Isaiah and Jeremiah and other books, you need to realize that they are not of the same vein. Okay, I'm struggling to find specific words because scholarly discussion hasn't really identified the best words to use in this domain. Now, what I want to say about this is this, and you'll get this more fully as we go through the different books of the Bible. If you take, for example, in Jeremiah, we find a fascinating situation where the Hebrew Bible, the Septuagint version, is radically shorter than the Hebrew Bible. Okay, the Hebrew seemed to the Masoretic tradition has expanded. Okay, now this is strange because an older school of thought would have said that the shorter is original and the longer is an expansion. If that's the case, then the Samaritan Pentateuch of Jeremiah would be an earlier edition. And people like Emanuel Tov, Batarmelei, have argued along these lines, and we'll talk about it then. On the other hand, if you look at even any of the Pentateuchal sources, the Septuagint has many, many pluses. Okay? In other words, there's additions to the text. So the they have taken a different cluster of manuscript witnesses and put them together. And that's why Emanuel Tov's comment here in terms of, although this understanding may change, that's what's behind this comment. There's more to the issue. There's more to the discussion than what is superficial. Now, the second stage, or what we might call the second period, identified on located on slide 15, the period of relatively high degree of textual consistency. Okay, this moves out of the Qumran period, and you begin to see a streamlining within the Masoretic tradition from the destruction of the Second Temple until the 8th century CE. Remember, it's the 7th, 8th century where you have the strong Masoretic influence in terms of vowel pointing, moving beyond just the consonantal text. Documents, for example, from the Judean desert, Wadi Murabaat and Nahar Hever, written, you know, a little bit before the Bar Kokhba rebellion, 132 to 135, clearly indicate a streamlining along these lines. I personally wanted to check out for myself this hypothesis because obviously, you know, when you're studying, you always want to try to find holes within the what scholars consider to be standard interpretations. And I read through most of the Wadi Murabaat material, and surprisingly, proto-Masoretic coming into the Masoretic. With the little bits and pieces of manuscripts that we have from these sources, we have very few variants in terms of true variants. Yes, there's an adding of a vowel letter here or there, but to a large extent, you're seeing a very strong stabilization. Also for our study, there's a gap in terms of the manuscript evidence, and one of the next earlier blocks ends up in what we would call the Cairo Geniza material. The Cairo Geniza material is, a Geniza is actually a section within a synagogue where old manuscripts were kept. Okay. Now, in other words, you know, let's say you have a faulty Hebrew Bible; it's been copied and it doesn't stand the test. What would you do with it? Well, instead of burning it, you wouldn't burn a Bible. You would put it in the Geniza. Old, worn manuscripts the same way. And in Cairo, when this synagogue was being refurbished, they stumbled across this unbelievable cache in the late 1800s, early 1900s. A German scholar, Paul Colley, although I think that there's much debate. I would say that there's more work to be done on the Cairo Geniza material, but the problem is that Qumran is more interesting, and so very few scholars have endeavored to really sort out the issues that Paul Colley was dealing with. So I'm going to leave that as it were. Once again, if you want to talk with me about that further, it would be a pleasure. Paul Colley, the first edition of his Cairo Geniza volume is online, and you can download it and read it. The second edition, which he expanded it by more than 100 pages, the APTS library has a copy. It is quite different in terms of his maturation. He responds to criticism. So, anyway, it's a good field of study. The third period that we talk about that we can understand, number 16, slide 16, the period of almost complete textual unity from 8th century until the end of the medieval period. This is the period of Rabbi Ishmael in his discussion of not one letter. Okay, as Tov says, the earliest dated Masoretic manuscript scripts proper are from the 9th century and are characterized by the introduction of vocalization, cantillation signs, that's the singing signs for canting, and the Masorah, the consonantal text of the individual codices, that's a book form, rather than a scrolls, are virtually identical. Okay? Now, Moshe Goshen Gottstein continues this discussion in terms of Masoretic text and talk about the printed second rabbinic Bible, which is what we call an eclectic text. If you ever get the biblical Hebraic before Stukantensia, the 1 and 2, they use the rabbinic Bible. And that's why older commentaries, you might find that there's some distinctions, differences between what is the modern commentary, because they tend to use the Codex Leningradus. Okay, this was an eclectic text. They put things together. Okay, very similar to the Nestles and the American Bible Society's text, which is an eclectic text. There's no one manuscript dominant. In Biblical Hebraic Stukantensia, under the influence of Paul Colley, Eliger, the editor, made the shift to Codex Leningradus B19A. Dated to 1009, okay. You're going to be seeing a newer edition coming out slowly but surely. Maybe not completed within my lifetime, but the Aleppo Codex, which is lacking large sections in the first, the Torah is almost all gone in a fire. But the Aleppo text is probably a better edition of the Ben Asher tradition. And the Hebrew University Lewinger, the Mazora Magna of the Aleppo text. These are just sources for you. It's going to be hard to get a hold of. Although Ginsburg's six-volume collection is online, and you can download it and study it. If you're interested in the Vey edition of Stukantensia, I do have a copy of it that I work with. For my own work, so you could come and I will allow you to take a look at it if necessary. Okay, now, let's move on. In terms of manuscripts, okay, remember there's a difference. Manuscripts would actually be each, hard copy, okay, if we use a modern term. And the manuscript evidence then is those materials that are found in the Dead Sea Scroll, Qumran, the Murabaat, Masada, Nahar Hever. These locations have produced actual manuscripts. Number two, we may mention of the Nash Papyrus, Exodus 22-17, that's the Ten Commandments, and partially Deuteronomy 5:6-21, which is also the Deuteronomy version of the Ten Commandments. Okay, and remember we said that this is dated to about 1st and 2nd century CE, Common Era, a little bit older. It's not as old as the Qumran sources. The Geniza fragments, which I've mentioned to you, then the second source, 8th century and following, and then the whole series of Ben Asher manuscripts. The Aleppo text, remember it's been burned in the first part and the latter part, but it dates to about 925. Other texts are the 10th century codex of the Karaite synagogue. It contains a Pentateuch, Codex Leningradus, 1009. Okay, and then a series of other three other manuscripts that I've mentioned here. The Codex BM or 4445, the Codex Sassoon 507, the Codex Sassoon 1053. Now, those last two are actually used by the British Bible Society Hebrew Bible. Okay, I don't know if you've seen it. It has no real major text critical apparatus. But it's another one that floats around. By the way, in modern Israel, they use what is called the Koren, not the Quran, but the Koren edition, which is then also just a little bit different from these manuscript evidences, but basically a modification of the rabbinic Bible. Okay, I have listed a few pictures. The famous first edition of the Psalter of 1477, one of the earliest printed Bibles, the Plutensia polyglot, and then some rabbinic to Talmudic comments. In other words, you're getting the beginning of text criticism, sort of a modified version of the Hexapla. Here, not just a series of Septuagint writings, but here a series of multiple lingual works. And you can understand, here's where there's beginning a development in terms of the importance of retroversion. Okay, they have to translate the material back. Codex Cairensis, we have Aleppo, several in terms of Aleppo. I must say that if you go to my website, you'll find links to several very, very important websites that have scanned in the Aleppo Codex, and it's wonderful. You can open up, it's beautiful graphics, you can read the text online for those of you that read Hebrew. It can be very important. The Firkovich collection, I believe that's in Harvard. Codex Leningradus, have pictures of Kennicott, beautiful edition, 1776 to the 80s. The inscriptions are marvelous there. Okay. Now, finally, we're making our way to slide 33. Okay. Outside the Masoretic text, the next witness that we must talk about is what we call the pre-Samaritan. Notice it's not called proto-Samaritan, but the pre-Samaritan and the Samaritan Pentateuch. Okay? Now, we really should sort of separate the two, but because we're so excited about finding a Samaritan-based text, contains the text of the Torah, because that's where they feel that the authority lies, written in a special version of the early Hebrew script. If you look at the picture, the Hebrew script is different. This is it's usually called Paleo Hebrew. And it's kind of interesting. In the Talmud, they have prohibited this kind of script, which seems weird, because that would mean that the older manuscripts are being rejected. Okay? This is another problem that hasn't been solved. Emanuel Tov came out with a journal article not that long ago, and he has a fascinating hypothesis. Looking at the Qumran material, specifically the Paleo-Hebrew material, he has mounted an argument that the Paleo-Hebrew material in Qumran is from is Sadducee based. In other words, that's the Sadducee Bible, from his opinion. Okay, wow, a very interesting thing. We know that we have the Paleo Paleo portions of Leviticus, of Exodus, and also what else do we have? Leviticus, Exodus. I think we have some. I'm not sure about the Deuteronomy. I have to double check on that. But all in all, he's arguing from that vein. Now remember, this is different. There's some interesting things here. For example, does that mean then that the Samaritan, K4 Qumran Numbers B text, which is very much of a Samaritan Pentateuch tradition, it is not in Paleo Hebrew? Okay. Leviticus, we can't tell. And the reason why we can't tell is that the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Masoretic, Proto-Masoretic tradition is virtually the same there. But all in all, I think that the Numbers and the Exodus text clearly indicate to us that the Samaritans later on, when they developed this Samaritan text type, they actually moved in the direction of, on purpose, using the Paleo-Hebrew script to present an antiquarian flavor to the text. In other words, making it look old. Archaic. Although that's probably a pejorative way of talking about it. Who's to say that they didn't have early manuscripts? Okay. So let's make a distinction here in terms of this aside that I've just given you. The Samaritan Pentateuch, okay, is a later development, but at Qumran we did find earlier pre-Samaritan material. Okay, the Samaritan stuff has their own secretarian editions, which we'll talk about shortly. But this strange Paleo-Hebrew writing is seems to also be used and dominate in the early days with the Sadducees. Okay, now, continuing on to the next slide, 34. This text is permeated. We're talking about the Samaritan penitent, not the pre-Samaritan text. The Samaritan, slice them off very easily. Scholars are divided in their opinion on the date of this version, but it was probably based on an early pre-Samaritan, okay, text, similar to those found in Qumran. Okay? So the Samaritans chose a specific text. And they don't like me to use this word, but text type, text grouping that was very similar in how they handled the text. The next, and we might call them expansionistic or harmonistic in its nature, which is an issue that I'm still working on. Now, slide 35, origin and background to the Samaritans is probably an important aside to kind of consider. Tov writes, the Samaritans themselves believe that the origin of their community goes back to the time of Eli, the 11th century B.C. That's at the Shiloh temple, remember? When the Jews withdrew from Shechem to establish the new cult in Shiloh, which was later brought to Jerusalem. So, what the Samaritans then argue, okay, that their religious foundation begin, and there is original. They are the pre-Jerusalem location of the ark and the place of worship. It was at Shechem. Later on, it was moved, and they see that as apostasy. Okay, and remember, the book of Samuel begins with a rather negative depiction of Eli and his sons. And therefore, they would be able to pick up on that type of understanding. Now, on the other hand, for example, Second Kings. So there's a difference. Now here's the problem here. Is it possible that some of this is a sort of polemic? Okay. How would you explain this? So the Assyrians, exiled people, shifted them around, and made a new population there. But the Samaritans might very well be correct in that there was a core group that was there that might have maintained a Shechem. Like Shechemite-like tradition. In other words, we might find that both is true. The Second Kings taken in isolation to what the Samaritans say might be a polemic that is a strong attack. We say this because later on when we look at Joshua and Judges, the text itself, and compare the pre-Masoretic material, we do know that the Masoretic text has been changed in its order of presentation of material, probably to put down the Samaritans. Okay, this would be a much later addition then. Okay, and we do know that there was a big controversy during the times of the Hasmoneans, the Maccabean period. Okay, in fact, the religious temple that was found in Shechem is burned, and what's the character of it? The character of the Samaritan Pentateuch, the standard thing is that when compared with the Masoretic text, there's over 6,000 details, 6,000 differences, and of those, the Samaritan Pentateuch agree with the Septuagint 1,600 occasions. Okay, this is something that's been found in all sorts of reference works. However, working under Emmanuel Tov at the University of Hebrew University, Kwan Ray Kim, in his doctoral dissertation in 1994, he argues, concludes that the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Septuagint agree over against the Masoretic text in 964 cases. 471 of these are insignificant, while among the 493 remaining, 328 are common harmonizations of the text. So the differences are probably not as great. Actually, there was one article that looked at the Genesis and Exodus material, and at Qumran, and really questioned if we could say that the pre-Samaritan textual grouping was really fundamentally different than the Masoretic. Okay, that's, in other words, you can make a distinction, but how do you do that? What is the percentage of error? Remember, we talked about how, you know, the 85% in terms of the textual from other parts of the Torah in an expansionistic fashion. Now, take a look at the chart on the side. You notice the first column gives you Deuteronomy passages, and these were inserted after these other passages in Numbers 10:10. For example, Deuteronomy 1:6-8 is inserted. In Exodus 18:24-25, Deuteronomy 1:9-18 are inserted. Okay, so this chart shows you where Deuteronomy is inserted. Now, what is the reason for this? Is it to harmonize because they're conflict? Well, if you look at some of them, they're not that much different. In other words, it's almost a interpretative one. Now, this is all me, okay? This is my own analysis of this issue, and it's an area that I'm quite concerned about. And I don't think that the Eschels or Kim or Tov have really nailed this idea. There's a nagging question, okay? In these narratives, there's insertions to harmonize, which many times do not need harmonization. Okay, they don't have to correct any error. But when there are different readings in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy concerning specific laws, there is no attempt to harmonize them. And we have to ask the question, why? Did they not like the laws? Were they not interested in the details of it? Or is it that these so-called harmonistic, these insertions might have a different significance? And that's sort of what I'm on. Exodus 28, it begins with Zakar, remember. Okay, and in Deuteronomy 12, it begins with Shamor, observe, in terms of the Sabbath. But the Samaritan Pentateuch reads Shamor in both versions. In other words, they harmonized according to Tov. Okay, so they corrected and made it all the same. Now, furthermore, number two, there's linguistic corrections. This is found in both the pre-Masoretic and the Samaritan Pentateuch. Well, what are we talking about here? Well, if the verb does not agree with the subject, or there's pronominal errors, it's a plural rather than being singular. Many times you have errors in which you have Moses said, or it was spoken to Moses and Aaron. You know, these kind of things. There's an addition of Aaron when necessary, or a subtraction of Aaron when necessary to correct the grammar. Okay, and later on we're going to find out that it's a fuller reading too. Okay, also secretarian changes in the Samaritan Pentateuch, which is not found. Let me reiterate, in the pre-Samaritan Qumran material. For example, the secretarian changes are specifically: number one, the place of worship is Mount Gerizim, not Jerusalem. Read John chapter 4. The addition of the commandment to the Decalogue after Exodus 20:12, Deuteronomy 5:18, which makes Mount Gerizim the proper place of worship. That means that the first commandment is your vowel letters. Okay, so it's a fuller text. Modern editions, for your own interest, is Van Gaal. This is online at the eBind site, Text Critical eBind site. The Sadaka is a Samaritan text, okay, with the Hebrew Bible on one side. It's a very interesting combination. I tried to order this and it never got through. I'm going to probably try to order it again from the online site. Let me mention one more that's not on the PowerPoint. I found it brand new. The book is called The Torah, Jewish and Samaritan Versions Compared. It's written by Mark Scholson. He's obviously Jewish, and it's done very well. The Samaritan text that is used is the text that has been reworked by Abraham Tal. The Samaritan Pentateuch, edited according to manuscript 6C of the Shechem Synagogue. It is a very nice volume, dividing the text up. Actually, online, you can actually see a couple pages of it and how it works out. Notice also slide 42, a series of introductory texts. Let me highlight the works of Ingrid Helm. She's Scandinavian. Actually, she's the wife of Thomas Thompson, who's a famous minimalist scholar, has done some excellent work in the past in a journal article. Notice that she's rather long-winded in her writing. She obviously finds that the Masoretic material is very polemic. Remember, I kind of hinted at that. And and that we need to once again listen to the Samaritan material. Okay, obviously the Samaritans, the few that are left, really appreciate her work. I guess I might be a little bit ironic there, but the issue is more as if her argument is can hold water. I think there's much good in what she's writing, and I think that we really do need to hear this voice and relook at the material. I believe I blogged on some of her works not that long ago at my website. So you can get a summary of those things. Okay, notice the picture of the Samaritan Pentateuch, a manuscript dating from 1215. It uses the paleo script and with a beautiful artistic framework. Van Gaal's work with the critical apparatus. Okay, slide 45. We're talking about the Septuagint now. Okay, the Septuagint, the 70, is a Jewish translation which was made mainly in Alexandria. Okay, now please remember that there's a nomenclature problem. Technically, the Septuagint only refers to the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis through Deuteronomy. The Bible is the Septuagint. When in reality, the Septuagint only encompasses the first five books. But putting that kind of argumentation to the side because it's more technical, in common usage, we say Septuagint for the whole Greek Bible. Does that make sense? It's kind of a frustrating technical mistake that has been perpetrated and continued to be lived out. Okay, Septuagint is a Jewish translation which was made mainly in Alexandria. Its Hebrew source differed greatly from the other textual witnesses, the Masoretic, the Targum, the Syriac, the Vulgate, and many of the Qumran texts. Now, what we mean by this is that the Hebrew Vorlag is the German word there, that source material seemed to be different, okay? And this accounts for its great significance in biblical studies. Moreover, Septuagint is important as a source for early exegesis, and this translation also forms a basis for many elements in the New Testament. The last couple sentences here by Tove are very important and need to be unpacked clearly. First of all, we need to understand that number one, it reflects a different Vorlag of the Hebrew Bible. Okay, we know this because, for example, going back to the study of Jeremiah, which we'll talk about in more detail, we found a Hebrew edition similar to the Septuagint shorter edition. At least that's what we believe. Okay, and we found the longer Masoretic edition, the source. Or like the source of the Septuagint, okay? Which tells us, and remember, if it's true that this thing was translated 3rd century B.C., we're going to give some ideas about that shortly, then it's an early witness, and it's a very, very early witness that we need to grapple with in terms of the textual tradition. And number two, it's important to realize that much exegesis is found in it. Remember, when you translate, you interpret. Okay, I know the cynical part of Nietzsche made a statement one time: all translations are lies. That might be an overstatement, but I think that there is a certain amount of truth in the overstatement. That is, translations are interpretations. A can never equal A in a translated form. A becomes A prime. The language shift forces a movement there. And therefore, there even in this detail and in larger perspective, there are clear exegesis going on. They're interpreting the passage, okay, just as the Masoretes interpreted by adding vowel points, okay, and punctuation marks, etc. Okay, except in this case, it might be a little bit more explicit. And number three, from Tov's comments, is that important concept that the Septuagint. And you say, well, you know, why aren't the translations based on that? Well, blame it on Luther. Luther made that big shift. He did away with the Septuagint plus. That is the apocryphal works that were added on, which would tend to support the doctrine of indulgences, etc., etc. And it might not have been all a bad idea. I mean, I think it's very important that we have a Hebrew base, although you realize that some of the discontinuity between the Old Testament translations that you have now and the New Testament translations that you have now are because the Old Testament is translated from the Hebrew and the New Testament might have been citing the passage originally from the Septuagint or from the Greek Bible. Okay, so that it does cause probably a little bit more of a disjunction than what may have been in the original language. Okay, now, next slide, 46. Okay, utilizing, in terms of dating, utilizing Septuagintal manuscripts and citational evidence, Eugene Ulrich argues that the Greek translation of the Torah was made by the late 3rd century BCE. Now, that sounds like a good true and false question. Nina Collins, in a volume, very interesting volume, focuses primarily on the text Critical Comparative Analysis of the Letter of Aristeas. Now, this is a letter that talks about the origin of the Septuagint. A lot of work had been done on this, claiming it to be false. However, she argues that from this text that been a lot of scholarly interactions. Now, let's talk about the witnesses. The early texts were written on papyrus and leather and included both scrolls and codices. Codices are book form, okay? Bruce Metzger talks about it in terms of the development into almost a Christian development. And several other scholars have, and especially nowadays, there's a lot of interaction on this. It makes, remember, when you have scrolls, okay, you can't carry around the Bible, you know. Even the Old Testament, you know, there you have a scroll, Torah scroll. And in fact, for example, Isaiah is the length of a standard scroll. Okay? And that's why they say, you know, for example, Luke, Acts being separated because of the length of a scroll. Obviously, once you get a codex that can be written on both sides, bound form, you can get a lot more words on there, and it becomes a book. So, you know, that witness is found more within the Septuagintal tradition. 2nd century BCE onward, many fragments in Palestine and in Egypt. The Chester Beatty Shiden collection that was originally from Egypt, 1931, contained most of the books and even Daniel. And in fact, even in Qumran, we have, for example, the famous K4 Leviticus, Septuagint Leviticus. We also have sources for manuscripts. Let's continue. Now, the early manuscript material was very much in the uncial or what's now called majuscule manuscripts. In other words, from the 4th century onward, these are all written in caps. The major codices that you have is, number one, represented by the letter B, Vaticanus. It dates to about the 4th century and is considered the best complete manuscript of the Septuagint. And it's relatively free of corruption and influences of the revisions of the Septuagint. Okay? The second one is represented by S or Aleph, in terms of the Hebrew letter Aleph, and it's Sinaiticus. It dates to the 4th century, usually agrees with the Vaticanus, when the two reflect the old Greek translation, but the Sinaiticus is influenced by later revisions of the Septuagint. Now, both of these are found in the Ebind text that I've given you. Another important witness, 5th century, is that of Alexandrius. It's influenced by it's greatly influenced by the hexaphleric tradition. That means after the Hexapla, these texts were very, very dominant, and they influenced in several works. So, just to give you a background, you notice that we have pictures of these, at least Alexandrius there. Now, three, the minuscule, that is a cursive manuscript unknown. If you take the Gutenberg and the Cambridge edition of the critical editions of the Septuagint, they clearly represent those and are strongly represented. On slide 54, you'll notice I'm trying to introduce you to the critical works that you would use if you studied in this area. Brooks, McLean, and Thackeray, over a long period, 1906 to 1940, has put together what is commonly called the Cambridge Septuagint. Okay, it's multi-volume, then you can download it from online. It's an excellent work. There's a picture there in terms of its detailed critical apparatus. Two, nowadays, although it's not quite complete, Ziegler has edited the Göttingen Stuttgartensia, Septuagintia, and it's a multi-volume work. Now, it is based on the ideas of Ralph. Okay. Now, Ralph is the one-volume Septuagint that you can buy. It's also the one. It's also the text that's used most likely in the digital format when you have Bible software. Realize that he did this edition, and it's intended to be a eclectic edition. And with critical apparatus in the bottom. However, this Ralph's edition has almost no major critical apparatus. The text, they haven't really increased the textual apparatus because that's in the Göttingen Septuaginta, and it's way too massive. You know, each book of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, or all Deuteronomy, all these are just one volume in themselves. Okay, because of the graphic, but the new Ralph edition is has been realigned with what the scholars have been working on in this eclectic edition. Okay, you got a copy of a page from Numbers. Okay, now let's talk about the importance of the Septuagint. It's not really the importance, but the distinctions. For example, a scholar named Brown studied the Genesis 1 and 2 and argued that the Genesis passage in the Septuagint was probably reflects an older and better text. If we would then move on to dealing with issues such as the genealogies that are represented in, which is a crucial element in the book of Genesis, it is argued that it's substantially different. They use a different chronological flow. Exodus, for example, in the second, the reiteration of the tabernacle, building on the tabernacle passage, chapter 35 through 40, is totally different. Okay, I mean it doesn't exist. God commanded them to build the tabernacle, and they did. Okay, whereas in the Masoretic text, they commanded, and then this is what they did, and it's explained in chapter 35 to 40. Okay, so there's a clear distinction there. Exodus is shorter. The Exodus Septuagint passage is shorter. Numbers, there are positions and pluses, positional differences and pluses and minuses. Samuel and Kings, major and minor differences, including pluses and minuses, transpositions of passages, in other words, chapters are different, involving different chronologies and editorial structures. Jeremiah, difference in sequence, and it's much shorter in the text. Ezekiel is a much shorter text in the Septuagint. Proverbs, for example, differences in sequence and some passages just downright different texts. Daniel and Esther has additions. Okay, and in fact, the additions are quite often relegated to being apocryphal, but they are different. That's the Septuagint plus of F.F. Bruce. Chronicles has many synoptic variants. In other words, it's aligning itself with Samuel and Kings. Readings in the Greek translation of the Chronicles agreeing with the Masoretic text in parallel passages. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Okay, so just to give you a framework of the differences. Generally, the Septuagint and the revisions share a common textual basis. Now, what we're talking about is that the Septuagint was translated, and after that, there was a series of retranslations. This is a very, very frustrating part of working in the Septuagint. We find that the Septuagint being used by Christians then was altered by the Jewish dominantly Christian. In other words, it goes back and forth. And this whole process is very frustrating. It's not as controlled as what you see and stabilizing as what you see in the later Masoretic processes. Now, one major form is what we call the Theodotion, which has been called the Kaige version. Now, why is it called Kaige? Well, the Hebrew word gam has been translated as Kaige, as representing a unique translation. Also, the Kaige translation, unlike earlier translations, took the there is a word that is looks the same, but it has two it's a homophone, and it's aleph tau s. Okay, it can be used to understand a preposition with. And therefore, it's translated into the Septuagint soon. Okay? And in the early forms, no matter where it showed up, it was translated that way. However, quite often, S is used as a direct object marker and shouldn't be translated. The Kaige tradition no longer translates F as soon every time. Okay? So, it obviously is a later development. The Greek scroll of the Minor Prophets at Nahar Hever, which I've mentioned to you, was identified as an early Kaige revision of the Septuagint by Barthélemy in a very, very important work that kind of transformed Septuagintal studies. Also, in the sixth column, supplemented the current Greek version, and it has supplemented the current Greek version of Daniel. In other words, in terms of its manifold, it seemed to correct the Septuagint basically with a Hebrew text, okay, which makes it very, very confusing. The Aquila edition. Now, Aquila is a difficult one to handle. Aquila prepared his revision in approximately 125 CE. Some biblical books have two different editions. It is claimed that he was a student of Rabbi Akiba. Wow! And Tov writes, Aquila made an attempt to represent accurately every word, particle, and even morpheme. For example, he translated the nota accusa F separately with soon. Ah, see there? With apparently on the basis of the meaning F, meaning with. Okay, just what I explained to you about the Kaige, which doesn't do that. The Aquila does. Okay? Aquila, then, in terms of sort of a mythic biography, is identified with Onkelos, who is one of the major translators of the Targum of the Torah, the Onkelos edition. This is probably pretty well mythic. But it's a very interesting idea. The third is the Symmachus. It's 2nd, 3rd century CE, either a Samaritan who had become a proselyte or a Jewish Christian Ebionite. Symmachically opposed tendencies are visible in Symmachus's revision. On the one hand, he was very precise, while on the other hand, he was very often he very often translated ad sensum, rather representing the Hebrew words with stereotyped renderings. Okay, so maybe dynamic equivalent would be, so he bounced back and forth. The next major revision is what we call the Hexapla, origin in the mid-3rd century, the six columns. Here what's important is he used the insignia, the obelus, it looks like a division mark, And this represents elements in Greek but not in Hebrew. And the asterisk, which is a circle with an X in it, that is extant, it appears in Hebrew but not in Greek, which is added to the fifth column from one of the other columns. Okay, now post-hexaflaric revisions, and we kind of mentioned this, is Lucian, and it's identified in the Cambridge Septuagint, and known from both Greek and Latin sources, now maybe even in Hebrew. So the Septuagint, we have an early form of this in, according to Urich's, Eugene Urich's doctoral dissertation at Harvard, he argues that, and also the most recent Scrolls from the Judean Desert series, it argues that K4 Samaritan A probably represents this early text type. Okay, and obviously the dates are all wrong. It has to be found even earlier. Okay, good books to read, helpful sources. Jenny Julico has written two volumes, one a collection of essays, and then the Septuagint and Modern Studies, which has been a standard work for years. I have really appreciated the translation of Natalio Fernandez Marcos, The Septuagint in Context. It's an excellent volume, published by Brill 2001. It's paperback edition, so you can afford it. It's a very different take. I've read through all these, and each one takes a different take. Karen Jobs and Moshe Silva, The Invitation to the Septuagint, is a very reader-friendly, user-based work. And probably the most technical is Emmanuel Tov's The Text Critical Use of the Septuagint in Biblical Research. The second edition has been translated into English. It's an excellent work. I do have to say that he presupposes that trying to find the text ultimately, and therefore the use of the Septuagint is something that might be questioned by some scholars. Okay, the fourth version that we want to talk about here, a translation, is the Peshitta. The Peshitta actually is a word that means simple translation or plain. This is from the it's a Syriac translation. If you notice a picture of it over on the side using the Syriac script. The Peshitta is of either Christian or Jewish-Christian origin. This has been debated ad nauseum, and the conclusion is still not out. The Hebrew vorlag of the Peshitta was more or less identical with the Masoretic text. The Peshitta offers fewer variants than the Septuagint, but more than the Targum and the Vulgate in terms of the text itself. The Targum adds a lot of material that you can clearly slice out. Okay, the Hebrew Vorlag for the Peshitta has been seen as close to an early Masoretic text, which you just said, most likely after the Septuagint had split off from the development of the Masoretic text. Wow. Yet at times, the Peshitta's Vorlag stands with the Septuagint trajectory when the Masoretic text has a corrupted reading. So there's obviously an attempt to correct the text. Some scholars argue for an early rabbinic oral vocalization of the text. Now that would be very interesting. Remember, we talked about the oral tradition, and it could be that oral tradition was brought right in and utilized for the Peshitta translation and played into the translation and at times the Targum-like interpretations. What are your good sources? The one volume Mikra volume is excellent, and there is an article there by Dirksen, an important he was an important Syriac scholar, the Old Testament Peshitta. Lamsa, George Lamsa, has written a full translation of the Bible, the Holy Bible, from the ancient Eastern text. It's a little bit you want to be careful here, and Lamsa is very, very dogmatic on the Peshitta edition is better than anything else, so you just need to be very careful here. And also way earlier, but it's an excellent work that gives a high level. Now I need to make a comment. Just because it says an introduction, don't believe that this introduction is in any way a simplistic thing, just like it's more of an eye-length tune. You need to really be able to read Hebrew, Aramaic, and definitely Syriac to be able to work through this volume. Some helpful online sources follow. Now, Targum. Okay, or Targumim. page 74. Targum means explanation, commentary, or translation. Both Jewish and Samaritan targumim exist. Im is the plural form, right? However, the Jewish targumim had a higher status within their own community. Therefore, it was used very strongly. Now, I should say that if you read the Talmud, you'll find out very clearly that people were not supposed to write translations. The targum was supposed to be actually a on-the-spot interpretation. Okay, and so a translation, written work, was prohibited. Okay, but it might have been, and this is where the speculation come in, that there was, for example, cheat sheets for the translation to help out, because the people, although they understood Hebrew, but they didn't understand it well, so they needed the translation into or the text interpreted into Aramaic. At the same time, we say this, Job. Well, one of the targums that was found in Qumran was actually this portion of Job, which seems to reflect a different vorlag, a different textual tradition. Okay, so in spite of what the Talmud argues, obviously it was written, and it is very, very intriguing in its nature. Now, let's continue. Jewish Targumim exist for all books of the Hebrew Bible except Ezra, Nehemiah, and Daniel, because they contain Aramaic portions. The Targumim reflect a Hebrew text that is very close to the MT, Masoretic text, except for Job Targum from Qumran, which I just represented. I should point out that, however, if you read through the Targum, you'll find out that there's a lot of commentary. Okay, but the reason why we say that the Targum represents a Masoretic tradition is because it's very easy to make a division between the commentary and the text, although they put the commentary in the text. Okay, but you can see it very clearly, and so you know it seems like it's translating the Masoretic text and then makes a comment. Okay. So the comments aren't interspersed necessarily. Now, there's several forms. We divide the Targum into two basic blocks, and I think we'll talk about that in a few seconds. But I think this is necessary before we jump into Targum Onkelos. Basically, you have the Palestinian Targums and the Babylonian Targums. Okay. And they seem to be different base, just like you have the Yerushalayim Aramaic. The same thing is in terms of the Targums. Okay, Talmud Targum, they're different. Okay, don't make a mistake there. Okay, so now going to slide 76, the Targum Onkelos, translated by Onkelos the proselyte. Remember, we don't think it's Aquilus, under the guidance of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua. The date ranges from 1st, 3rd, 5th century. What is it? As a rule, Onkelos follows a plain sense of the scripture, but in the poetic sections, it contains many exegetical elements. Alexander Spieber argues that there are 650 minor variants in the Targum Onkelos. Okay, that's just talking about the Torah. Now, the Palestinian Targumim in Torah is represented by, number one, the Jerusalem Targum 1, which is commonly called Targum Pseudo-Jonathan. Now, that's because the Jonathan Targum is represented in the Torah and the Ketubim, and represents that, and there seemed to be a understanding that there had to be a Palestinian edition of the Torah also, and they said, oh, this one must be from Jonathan, but in reality it's not. Therefore they call it Pseudo-Jonathan. The Jerusalem Targum 2 and 3, which are fragmentary targums from and also there's targums from Cairo Geniza. And also in 1956, they pulled out from the Vatican Library what is called the Targum to the Hagiographa. Okay, Tov writes on slide 79, the quality of the translation of the Aramaic Targums vary from Targum to Targum and from book to book. As a rule, the Targums from Palestine are more paraphrastic in character than the Babylonian ones. The more literal translations of Cave 11 Qumran, Targum Job, and K4 Qumran Targum Leviticus, though found in Palestine, are an exception to this rule. I think we need to be a little bit careful here. The geographic locations, Babylon, Palestine, is good, but these are general divisions, and there's some older theories that are still haven't been filtered through, I believe, in dividing this. Okay, slide 80. The Targum usually reflects the Masoretic text. Deviations reflect the Masoretic text. Deviations from it are based mainly on exegetical traditions, not on deviating text. In other words, it's not that Vorlag that's different. An exception must be made for the Job Targum from Qumran, which contains interesting variants and which possibly lacks some verses of the Masoretic text of 42:12-17, a fact which would be significant for the literary criticism of the book. It may perhaps be assumed that other Targums, that Targumim, in an early stage of their development also contain more variants than in their present form. The Targum Onkelos, as a rule, contains more variants than the Palestinian. Eitan Levin, the Aramaic version of the Bible, an excellent work. It's a thin work, very easy to read. Also, the first one by Alexander, which I cited before, the Jewish Aramaic translation of the Hebrew Scriptures in the Mikra volume, that we do have a copy of that in the library. Okay, some sources. Let's conclude with a little bit on the Vulgate. The Old Latin tradition, the lack of a complete critical edition of the Old Latin tradition is very, very frustrating. And there's been attempts to put it together. It's on 3x5 cards, supposedly, but it still hasn't been produced. Differing translations, consistencies from book to book, and the debate over whether there was a single original translation or multiple separate translations are just a few of the problems that plague the work of this witness. The Old Latin holds the potential for uncovering an early Greek tradition that attests to a better reading than the Masoretic in places. Ulrich has argued this as he works over the text of Qumranic following. Comparative material for analyzing the Targumic and Christian versions of Jewish interpretation in the Septuagint and an exposition of the beliefs of early Christians during the period of its writing and translation. Okay, although Jerome utilized a rabbinic Hebrew Bible for his Vulgate translation, he continued to rely on different Septuagintal witnesses in both his translation and commentaries, making it more of an eclectic text of the time.